Over NBC's coast-to-coast network of independent affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. Today, from a Harris Foundation meeting held recently on the University of Chicago campus, the Roundtable brings you a discussion of how to deal with communist subversion. Taking part in this transcribed discussion from Mandel Hall are Dwight McDonald, staff member of the New Yorker magazine, Daniel Bell, sociologist of Columbia University, and Quincy Wright, political scientist of the University of Chicago. Now, first we hear Mr. Wright.
In his first inaugural a century and a half ago, Thomas Jefferson said, if there be any among us who wish to dissolve this union or to change its Republican form, let them stand undisturbed as monuments to the safety with which error of opinion may be tolerated where reason is left free to combat it. Today, a research is going on at one of our important universities on the world revolution of our time. Its originators say it is based, and I quote, on the proposition that the 20th century has been witnessing the emergence of a world of garrison prison states. This involves the reversal of the prevailing 19th century trend toward a democratic international community, end quote. No one familiar with the developments in fascist Italy, Nazi Germany, Franco-Spain, communist Russia, and communist China can question this trend. Some observers of the Espionage Act, the political trials, the congressional committees, the publications such as Red Channels, the loyalty purges in the federal service and academic institutions, and the new methods of invading the privacy of the citizen see signs of an encroaching garrison prison state even in the United States. Is Jefferson's confidence in the self-sustaining power of freedom reasonable under present conditions? Can freedom of discussion protect the state against those who use freedom to destroy it? Have our recent practices diminished time-honored constitutional liberty? Must the United States become a garrison prison state to protect itself from the subversion of domestic communists supported by the power of the Soviet Union? These are large questions on which opinions differ. Bell, what is the communist danger in this country?
Professor Wright, the problems posed by the challenges to freedom from international communism can no longer be met, it seems to me, by a comfortable quotation from Jefferson or a neat homily from Mill. These men were concerned, and rightly so, with the right to dissent. The right to dissent, the speech of dissent, the act of dissent, are the foundations of a free society. What we face today, however, is not only dissent, but in a distinction enunciated by Sidney Hook, we also face conspiracy. And the problem, therefore, it seems to me, is one of differentiating between heresy or dissent and its rights and that of conspiracy. I would say the distinction rests on this basic and fundamental fact, that each individual must relate himself to the community in which he resides. The man who is orthodox is in the world and of it. The heretic or dissenter is part of the community, but not of it. He doesn't belong and wants to change it. The communist, however, is neither in the world nor of it. He stands outside of it, the perpetual alien, hostile to its aims, eager to destroy it. Even if this alone were the case, we would have a bitter but possibly a simple division, a conflict deeply irreconcilable, which in its meaning might parallel the religious wars of the 16th century, and in part such was the case even in the war against Nazism. But the communist goes even beyond that. He is a conspirator masquerading as a dissenter. PC, of better housing, of freer culture, and other liberal causes in the accents of the liberal. But these, even in his own terms, are transparencies. He himself even talks of fronts, the Potemkin villages, the facades behind which he will manipulate the people that he wants to manipulate. And beyond that is the aim of destroying a free society. A communist is a man who believes in a system of two truths, an inner truth of the elite and a truth of the masses. Now, this fact of conspiracy is not new. It is not a mode of conduct dictated by some present or immediate need to go underground to escape repression today. It was present in the very origin of communism and in our own country of American communism. In 1919, the newborn American communist movement predicted that a revolution would sweep the United States here. They thought that because in Russia, in Hungary, in Bavaria, revolutionary movements are taking power, that such would be the event here, too. In fact, they were encouraged by the situation wherein a wave of strikes had been spreading across the country. The port of New York at that time was shut down drum tight. A general strike had been declared in Seattle. There was a large strike in steel. In their own terms, there was a whiff of class warfare in the air. In fact, they were deceived. These legitimate strikes declared by a labor movement had been tied down during the war and whose wages had lagged. But for the communists, however, this whiff of class warfare was a wind that seemed to herald the apocalypse. They issued proclamations calling for mass insurrections. In some parts of New York, they called upon the workers and peasants of the Lower East Side to revolt. And in Brooklyn, they called for a Flatbush Soviet. Much of this was stupidity, much a reckless and posturing romanticism. But from that time on, however, the party was whipped into shape. For 3 years, the party itself was underground to prepare for a revolution. In 1923, it came up for air. But the party that emerged at that time with the name of the Workers' Party was already dominated by Moscow. Comintern representatives made basic decisions. And by 1929, after various quarrelsome factions had been expelled, that party was hardened and toughened. All this time, too, American communist leaders were sent to Lenin University in Moscow to be trained in tactics of propaganda and street fighting. American party leaders like Earl Browder and Eugene Dennett were dispatched to China to help the Chinese communists. Others were sent to South America. And in turn, Russian and German agents were brought here to guard the American party. All this was possible because this was an international movement and their purpose was international civil war. In the 1930s, the Communist Party created its own underground here too, with cells in Washington, New York, and Hollywood, and various academic centers. Many of these were so-called sleeper units. Their names never disclosed. Their function to further the party line, and in some cases, as we know now, espionage. But even on a simpler bread-and-butter level, they functioned to keep non-communists out of jobs, and even in some cases, denounced anti-communists to the FBI and to the Diet Committee as communists. They captured unions and twisted them for party purposes. This was not a game of tiddlywinks or abstract dialectical disputation. These men had a sense, a frosty and tingling sense of secretly making history. That seems to me the nature of the communist conspiracy and its purposes. And this distinction from heresy with its traditional right to dissent must be kept clear. Our traditional civil liberties protect dissent. But the English common law, of which we are also a part, has never tolerated conspiracy. A conspiracy, it seems to me, has no civil rights other than judicial guarantees of fair trial and due process. In this respect, too, we must distinguish between ideas and a movement, between communism as an idea and communism as a movement. A communist, one who is a member of a movement, is a disciplined individual whose fundamental aim is to wreck our society. What right can such an individual claim? The right of a job in government? The right to teach in schools where he can indoctrinate or try to dominate a department? Or enroll students, as some did in Young Communist League? It's like the pyromaniac claiming the right to be a fireman because he likes to be at fires. Seems to me to protect freedom, we must understand who is dissenting and who is part of conspiracy. And that's the fundamental problem, seems to me, of the nature of communist subversion.
Donald, do you think we're getting hysterical about this situation?
Well, yes, I do think we're getting a little hysterical. Last fall, Bertrand Russell, after a visit to the United States, wrote as follows. Any Englishman going to America at the present time has a strange experience of a population subjected to a reign of terror and always obliged to think twice before giving utterance to any serious conviction. End of quote. This is exaggerated, as our very discussion tonight shows, but unhappily there's some truth in it also. And we must take seriously such a reaction from a man who has been critical of Soviet communism since 1920, unlike certain other European critics of American democracy. I imagine Mr. Russell had in mind such items as these. Item, the jailing of the top communists, not for being unregistered agents of a foreign power, which they are, but for being revolutionaries, which they are not. Item, the use of political blacklists to deprive people of their jobs. The Attorney General has compiled one of subversive organizations. Some former FBI agents have compiled another, Red Channels, of radio and television performers. Mere listing in these blacklists is enough, in most cases, to lose a person his job. Another item. The Persian of school and college textbooks for allegedly un-American ideas, such as, these are actual examples, sympathy for the United Nations and defining the United States as a democracy instead of as a republic. Item. The refusal of the State Department to give passports to citizens whose trip abroad the department thinks will not or may not be, quote, in the best interest of the United States, end quote. And no explanation is needed on the part of the State Department. You can't get a hearing even. You can't take it to court. It amounts to imprisoning American citizens in the United States, of course. Item. Above all, the rise in the last 2 years of McCarthyism, by which I mean the persecution of individuals through unproved and often unprovable charges that they are or were tainted by communist sympathies. Demagogic liars like Senator McCarthy have created such an atmosphere that when some crackpot last year accused Anna Rosenberg, now Assistant Secretary of War, of having been a member of the John Reed Club in 1930, it took a week of congressional investigation and big headlines to find out that Anna Rosenberg indeed was a member of the John Reed Club in 1930, only it was another Anna Rosenberg. This then is briefly what has been happening. Personally, I regard communist totalitarianism as the chief enemy today of practically every value that I hold. But such methods of fighting it seem to me both impractical and immoral. Practically speaking, they are, one, not needed. The communists are no longer a political or ideological threat in this country. They shot their last bolt with the Wallace 1948 presidential campaign, which was a fiasco. They've been cleaned out of the Union, and by relatively democratic methods, such as exposure and voting. The Daily Worker is down to about 10,000 circulations. The real communist threat today is sabotage and espionage, this, the atomic spies. And in this field, the methods of McCarthy and McCarran and the Smith Act just don't make any sense at all. Secondly, practically speaking still, the second point is that they are not effective, these methods. Because they got the real communists and communist sympathizers all mixed up with sincere liberals and radicals. Since if everybody is a communist or can be smeared as one, then nobody is a communist. The term becomes so broad as to lose all meaning. The real communists are the gainers, since such methods give them the status of martyrs over here and abroad lend color to their charges that the United States is anti-democratic. Now, morally speaking, these methods are bad because they reshape us in the image of the totalitarian enemy. It is the essence of a free society to make distinctions between words and acts, between an individual's professional work and his political brief, between motives and consequences, between the past and the present. In short, to make distinctions. It is the essence of totalitarianism not to make such distinctions, but to reduce every aspect of the individual to his relation to the state. The communist leaders were jailed under the Smith Act for, quote, advocating the violent overthrow of the government, end quote. That is, for saying something as against doing something. The theory was that they might later commit a crime. Punishing not acts, but the possibility of acts, is normal Nazi-Soviet practice, but not good Anglo-Saxon law. When radioactives are fired because they once joined a communist front, or when Graham Greene has trouble entering the country because as a youth he briefly belonged to the British Communist Party, then we have a totalitarian conception of politics, in which one past misstep damns a man forever, and political guilt, like original sin, can never be atoned for or washed away by repentance.
I want to suggest two points on which it seems to me we are in agreement. First, international communism does present a danger to America, not only because of the military power of the Soviet state, but also because of domestic activity of the Communist Party. But the danger lies not in communist public propaganda or other direct efforts to influence opinion. If that were the only danger, I believe the freedom of discussion which Jefferson relied on would still be adequate to defend American institutions. The danger lies rather in the establishment of a highly organized group of persons devoted to espionage, to preparation for sabotage, and to infiltration into governments and organizations in order to breed attitudes of disunity, defeatism, and in some instances, directly to influence policy. No one who has studied the activities of the Communist Party, I think Mr. Bell made it clear, can question that there are dangers which must be met, nor can it be questioned that it is difficult to meet them within our constitutional principles. The problems of espionage and sabotage, which Mr. McDonald referred to, can be dealt with by the police and courts using time-honored methods. Distrust, hostility, and doubts as to our institutions and as to the value of freedom are precisely what the communists want in American opinion. It might be difficult to say whether the communist infiltrators or the patriots who try to detect them are doing the most service to the Kremlin. We seem to be in a position that to avoid being infiltrated by communists, we must develop the very state of mind which the communist infiltrators want us to have. And these conditions of dangers from subversive infiltration and dangers from efforts to meet them seem to me to be facts which we ought to do something about.
Well, you take such a case as the Dennis case.
That case was appealed to the Supreme Court of the United States, and they found that there was such a conspiracy and that the Smith Act was constitutional in permitting the criminal indictment and liability of persons who engaged in such a conspiracy, although the conspiracy consisted, as the court said, in the preparation of an organization which, not immediately, but in course of time, was designed to be used for the purpose of upsetting the United States government by force and violence. Now, that was a judicial procedure. One may think that the court went a little far in its distinction between conspiracy and the freedom of speech guaranteed. And there is always a line to be drawn there, because the conspiracy means that people have simply been talking to each other about what they're going to do. And that comes, if you say that that's criminal, it comes pretty near to being a limitation on freedom of speech. But the point I'm making is that there was due process of law. That seems to me the fundamental principle that a person ought to have the opportunity to explain his own position and discuss the evidence which is brought against him before he is deprived of any normal right of a citizen.
Well, Mr. Wright, you speak of due process of law, but it seems to me the point here is that this Smith Act is a bad law, just as the Espionage Acts were. You know, in the history of this country, from the beginning until 1917, with two exceptions, we have had a remarkable legal and governmental tradition of free speech. The exceptions, of course, were the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1797, which resulted in the complete disappearance of the Federalist Party due to popular reaction against them, only a period of 2 or 3 years, followed by Jefferson, who immediately put in much more liberal kind of government. And the other exception was Lincoln's absolutely scandalous behavior during the Civil War, when, of course, he violated civil rights on a greater scale than they've ever been violated before or since. But that also was only just a very brief period, and it wasn't written into the basic law. In 1917, however, beginning with the first Espionage Act, and continuing through the second Espionage Act, and then in the Smith Act in 1940 and the McCarran Act last year, we have a legal foundation for punishing words and advocacy and not action. And this is the most basic kind of infringement of free speech. It was always held before 1917 that this was actually against the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. And this decision of the Supreme Court upholding the Smith Act, it seems to me, was a very disgraceful and illogical decision. And I mean, the very way in which it was presented was very poor. And I, for one, don't consider that due process of law at all.
May I come back to something which I think, from my point of view, tries to meet these problems? I'm against the Smith Act, too. I'm against the Smith Act because it invokes certain kind of legal penalties, and I would agree with Mr. McDonald, legal penalties which should not be invoked until there is a very explicit danger. I think we can quibble for a while about explicit danger, but in common sense terms, we would recognize it. In immediate sense, the Communist Party is not an explicit danger here. However, there is, I would say, a distinction between legal penalties and social penalties. After all, communism is a moral affront to people in this country. There are people who try to wreck institutions, and therefore one reacts back in moral terms. Just as in the 1930s, people organized anti-Nazi boycotts as expression of private opinion, as one can in the same way react against communists. On that same basis, one can invoke private opinion in private organizations to keep communists out of positions where they will do danger. It's in those terms of sophisticated exposure. And in terms of arguing for the invocation of social penalties rather than legal penalties, that I think the case against communism and the fight against it has to be made.
I think the great danger of that line of thought is that it's bound to hit a lot of people that are innocent. The problem of identification is such a very vital problem. Of course, that isn't the only problem, that persons... You may not mistake identification in that sense, and yet you'll castigate a person as being a communist or a dangerous character when he isn't at all, simply because of some association. And that's the problem I had primarily in mind in talking of due process, question of appraising proper evidence. Now, you probably, both of you, the recently published book on Salem witchcraft, and know how that hysteria went through the country, simply because the courts stooped so low as to use what was called spectral evidence. That is, somebody would point to somebody as being a witch and say that there was an owl up there in Rafter that was her spectral being that was telling her so. And that it wasn't very good evidence, but nevertheless the courts accepted it, and so this person and that person were found to be witches, and then these girls who were making the accusations would accuse almost anybody. And, of course, after a while, the thing got to be so absurd that all the best people in the community were being accused of being witches that it just blew up by its own weight.
That's the right.
That sort of thing can go on, and unless you stick to very close procedures for testing evidence, it seems to me that that thing can happen. Tom, Dick, and Harry will be pointed to as being a communist by Senator McCarthy or the McCarran Committee or somebody else, and you'll have terrible wrongs done.
Seems to me, Professor Wright, you were casting a verbal spell before. Let me point out, it is true, I don't think there are any witches. But it is also true, I think, that there are communists, and that these distinctions have to be made. Now, of course, there are dangers involved in it, and part of the problem is to how one makes these kind of distinctions. Let me point out, for example, that Mrs. Rosenberg was cleared. It was a heavy, cumbersome procedure. The procedure probably should not have been invoked in the first place if people had been a little more intelligent. But she was finally cleared. Again, and here's the problem. Should we or should we not expose communists, particularly those who are in a position to do damage? That seems to me there are procedures which have been recognized. For example, the CIO set up trial committees. They heard evidence and they expelled a number of unions because they knew that their organization was in danger. They acted and they acted intelligently. Now, my problem is, was that wrong?
Well, I'd like to know from Mr. Bell, would you favor the firing of a Hollywood scenario writer or a radio performer merely on the grounds that he has been absolutely proved to be an active member of the Communist Party and has contributed heavily to its funds and has made many speeches in its favor and has used his position in the sense that he's well known, that he's therefore of course used it in favor of the party, but in other words, he's done a lot outside for the Communist Party, but in his profession, he has not in any way, used this. He hasn't...
It seems to me, Mr. McDonald, part of the problem is to recognize not what you consider to be a distinction between a professional and a communist activity, but what the communists themselves do is a distinction. For a man who is a communist, there is no such distinction.
Well, why are we...
There is no such distinction for this reason. That if a man is, and I make a distinction between the innocent dupe and the fool and the fellow traveler, but there were people in Hollywood, hardened communists, who used their positions to keep other people out of jobs, to raise money for the party.
What's wrong with raising money for the party?
Because it's not done openly.
Not done openly?
Exactly. Well. These people are in a position to utilize large funds in order to help the Communist Party.
And they should do that if they're communists.
Let them do it openly.
Let them do it openly, too. Why shouldn't they go? No. Why shouldn't they do it secretly? What's wrong with that?
Well, I take it you wouldn't fire a person who is a communist from such a position
so
as that.
I would say if a man is one of these types of disciplined, hardened communists, yes. You get too often the kind of spectacle in Hollywood is one time on New Year's Eve of a party of screenwriters
when they were passing around various caviar pieces and cognac, and at the stroke of midnight, some of these people got up and, raising their glasses high, began singing, "Arise, ye prisoners of starvation, arise, ye wretched of the earth."
That's all right. I mean, that's good propaganda for our side. What's wrong? Let them do that.
Well, I'd like to raise another question.
I just wanted to continue on this because I have another question now. Mr. Bell, what would you say then? I mean, Pablo Picasso is a known and ardent member of the Communist Party. He contributes hundreds of thousands of francs, which he gets from selling his pictures, to American capitalists, to the Communist Party. And so therefore, you would logically, I think, have to be in favor of boycotting Picasso's pictures, not hanging them in a museum of modern art, and not buying them. And if not, why not? Unless you're just a cultural snob, of course. If you...
Well, my place doesn't run to Picasso. But again, you're avoiding the distinction I was making. I wasn't talking of individuals in their own terms, their own production, but individuals in positions. The way people work with others as part of an organized movement. Now, unless you see a communist as part of an organized movement, rather than a man like Picasso who's a fool and who's a dupe, largely because his own type of painting is barred in Moscow, as you know, whose own type of painting is very strongly disapproved of and who's used by them. But a man who is not a man like Picasso, there are other people who possibly for laws of libel cannot be named this directly, but there are people we know we cannot prove partially legally, but in common sense terms, in people you oppose, there are that type of individuals who are dangerous individuals in terms of how they use their positions, and that's the problem at stake.
But Picasso was using his position. He made the peace deal, for goodness sake. That's a great, much greater contribution than any of these poor radio actors did. He uses the position all the time to advance communism. I don't see this this distinction here.
It seems
I think he's just trying
to
get out of it.
Maybe a little distinction between recognition of a man's art and the utilization of a man in public communication services. I would certainly hesitate to, if I were running a radio or a broadcasting concern, I would hesitate to employ a person who is known to be a communist in such a service. The problem of dismissing a person without due inquiry of what communism, if he was a communist, meant to him, if he had been serving satisfactorily in such a service for a long time, you knew about the nature of the service and there was nothing against it, I think one should give him due process of law in that case.
You have just heard a transcribed roundtable discussion of How to Deal with Communist Subversion, which came to you from a Harris Foundation meeting held in Mandel Hall on the University of Chicago campus. Taking part were Dwight MacDonald, staff member of the New Yorker magazine, Daniel Bell, sociologist of Columbia University, and Quincy Wright, political scientist at the University of Chicago. The printed pamphlet of today's roundtable on how to deal with communist subversion contains the full text of the discussion. Single copies are 10 cents each. Send your order today to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. For $3, you may subscribe to the pamphlet for a full year. That's 10 cents for each, or $3 a year for roundtable printed pamphlets. Address the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. The roundtable is a public service presentation by NBC, the national broadcasting company.